afternoon. Welcome to this lunchtime lecture. My name is Ingrid Fisk. I work at the Centre for Open Learning. We're delighted to see such a large number of people at this lecture, but we're not surprised. Steve Biko's life, his radical intellect, and the cruel events surrounding his murder by the apartheid regime compel our attention even today, perhaps especially today, where his leadership and critique would have been so important. You are here, of course, also because of another intellect in our midst, Kolela Kwanku, who will consider the historical evolution of Biko's ideas inside the traditions of thought in the East Cape, has just joined UCT, and we're very, very pleased to welcome him here. He's published an important and well-received biography of Biko, called Just That, Biko, a biography. It came out towards the end of last year and can be found on the bookshop tables. I recommend it. For 4 years, between 2000 and 2004, he was founding director of the Steve Biko Foundation, and his knowledge of Biko is deep and wide. He's also been a fellow at the Du Bois Institute at Harvard, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a research fellow at the Public Intellectual Life Project at Wits University, held other key institutional positions at the HSRC and elsewhere in the world, and as I said, is now Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at UCT. An engaged and combative and sometimes controversial analyst for our times, he's written many articles in the press and in academic journals and contributed to numerous books on topics such as race relations in South Africa, the African Renaissance, Black intellectual history, and political culture and democracy. Please welcome Kolela Kwanku.
Thank you very much, Ingrid. Thank you all for coming. I wasn't expecting such a huge crowd. The title of my talk is Steve Biko in the Intellectual History of the Eastern Cape. But you could also keep in mind the end of the talk, which is towards a joint culture. Curiosity about the interior life of other people's day-to-day work is one of the most fundamental human impulses. And that same impulse is what led to the writing you now hold in your hands. I shall repeat, curiosity about the interior life of other people's day-to-day work is one of the most fundamental human impulses. And that same impulse is what led to the writing you now hold in your hand. No, that's not me. That's not my book. But it's a quote from Malcolm Gladwell's introduction to his book, What the Dog Saw. I was always curious about many things in my life, and I like to think that I remain curious. I was curious about the two strange names that my mother and my aunt added to my closer name. My mother called me MacPherson, and my aunt gave me Tennyson, because they could not agree on one. So I go around with those names in my ID and in my passport. As you can tell, my mother and my aunt were what you might call people of the book, otherwise in isiXhosa or isiZulu known as amakholwa or amaqhoboke. Otherwise, I've also referred to them as possessors of the bilingualism that Colin Bundy spoke about here yesterday. A syncretic identity that goes back to the African encounter with modernity in the 19th century. Indeed, they lived on Reverend John Brownlee's mission station in King Williamstown, a station and a town that Roger Levine reminds us owes its existence to the Xhosa chief Jan Tsatsu, or the Xhosa chief that we knew of as Gani Chapa. The town, of course, grew to become the capital of the province of Adelaide and later of British Cathedral. King Williamstown, in Noel Mostert's words, would become the new hub for a military system that was intended to descend like an imprisoning grid upon all the Xhosa, underneath which they would be made over. Close quote. According to Peiris, for the Xhosa, British Cathraria was a monster which swallowed them up. But King Williamstown was also soon going to be the intellectual center around which the graduates of Lovedale College gathered to map up new ways of responding to European modernity. According to Chris Saunders, it is at Lovedale that you begin to see the emergence of a new African consciousness. One of the most influential graduates of Lovedale was R.V. Selope Thema, arguably the most influential African public intellectual of the 1920s, and editor of the Bantu World. Selope Thema expressed this evolving consciousness being forged at Lovedale in this flowery language, and I quote, "Lovedale lifted the veil of darkness before my eyes and made me see life in a different light. It made me see the glory of God's creation, his greatness and the bounty of his love for the human race. Lovedale made me realize the Bantu race was created after God's image to fill a nobler place than that of servitude in the affairs of mankind. Lovedale opened my eyes and made me see the suffering of my people, their poverty and misery, and I felt the pangs of pain in my heart and I revolted." Same sentiment, of course, had been issued earlier or expressed earlier on by Tio Soga. So for the second half of the 19th century, Lovedale produced the men and women who would shape what I call African modernity, long before the African National Congress was formed. Among these intellectuals of what Dongela Masilela describes as a new African movement were indeed the likes of Tio Soga, probably the most influential African intellectual of the latter part of the 19th century, followed by John Temo Jabavu, who went to Hilltown. There was also W.B. Khubusana, the first member of parliament in the Cape, Elijah Makiwane and Pambani Mzimba, who were originators of the African Christian Church. There was also, of course, the man that A.C. Jordan describes as the soul of his people, S.E.K. Mkai, and whose biography I'm currently working on. And of course, among these were my own great-grandparents, Gwai Kyamzashe and Peter Kyamzashe. Gwai became a prominent public intellectual and columnist for Isigidimi Samaxhosa and wrote about life on the Kimberley mines, on the diamond mines in Kimberley. Peter, on the other hand, worked with John Tengo Jabavu and forming Imbube. These early African intellectuals filled the pages of newspapers such as Isigidimi Samaxhosa, otherwise known as the Kefa Express, Indaba, Imvuzo Abantsundu, and later Izwi Labantu, which of course was formed by Jabavu's rivals, prominent among whom was A.K. Soga. These men, and they were mostly men, although there were, of course, a handful of women, they were responding in more ways than one to the call issued in a poem by Isaac Woolcock, "Your cattle are gone, my countrymen, Go rescue them. Go rescue them. Leave the British loader alone and turn to the pen. Load it with ink, for that is your shield. Your rights are going. So pick up your pen, load it with ink, sit on a chair, prepare not to hope, but fire with your pen. What does this have to do with Steve Biko? In his book, The Frontier, Noel Mostert describes a meeting he had with Biko in King Williamstown in 1974, and I quote, "I found him as engaging as one could wish any human being to be. Touching 30, tall, loose-limbed, with the graceful, unhurried movement so characteristic of the Tosa." I don't know about that part. "And which transmits so naturally to speech, tone, and gesture, Steve Biko was an immensely attractive man." Close quote. Mostert also made a rather prophetic observation that, and I quote, I knew it was Steve Biko who appeared to me to be the man with the key to the immediate future. Close quote. But it is Mostert's observation about Biko's place in this lineage of African intellectual thought that I found most relevant in framing my biography. Where does Biko fit in all of this story? How did this history shape him, and how did he shape it? What Mostert did not do, of course, was to go into that history, to look at its sociology, and to look at the debates that animated those intellectuals. That is now my duty here at UCT, to teach our students about this history that spans over a couple of centuries and yet is outside of our textbooks and our curriculum. That's a great loss. To be sure, my curiosity about Biko started when I was a little boy, growing up in Ginsberg, as I said earlier. Because I was born into a reading culture, my first memory of one of my earliest memories is of an encyclopedia that my mother, herself a teacher, kept in our house. But also every day she sent me out to buy the Daily Dispatch in King Williamstown. The distance between Ginsberg and King Williamstown was short enough for me to walk, but long enough for me to go through the paper and present it to her ruffled up. I could not have been more than 10 years at the time. But I remember that I had a makeshift album of newspaper articles and photographs about Biko that I cut from the Daily Dispatch, which interestingly enough had a column by black consciousness activist Mapetla Mohapi. This was after Biko had convinced his increasingly close but skeptical friend Donald Woods to give the movement a column in the Daily Dispatch. Biko was thus always part of my physical, my political, and my intellectual landscape as a young boy growing up in Ginsberg and in King Williamstown. And of course, the personal connections go back decades between our families. My mother and his mother were rather awkward friends, one a teacher and the other a domestic worker. It was an interesting relationship to watch. My brother was close to Biko, told me he proposed a toast at Biko's wedding to Nsiki. And that's also because I suppose he was the only graduate in our township at the time. And the toast, for some reason, had to be done in English. My grandfather, Bigati Kyamzashe, was a son of Gwai Kyamzashe, played a big role in getting Biko the land on which he and Mampila Rampile would build Zanempilo Clinic. And Bigati Kyamzashe played a big role in convincing the King Williamstown municipality that Ligo's funeral could not be held in the little Anglican church in Ginsberg, and that it needed to be moved to the larger stadium in town called Victoria Stadium. This is King Williamstown, Victoria Stadium. But I was also curious about Steve's childhood in Ginsberg, which was in those days a particularly rough place with warring gangsters competing over territory. In writing this book, I spent hours and hours talking with his schoolmates and former girlfriends, something for which he became notorious. What came out of all this was a picture of a playful young boy who enjoyed being the prankster that he was than joining any political parade. He was widely regarded, of course, as the most intellectually gifted child in the community, which explains his admission into Loveday College, into St. Francis College in KwaZulu-Natal, and ultimately to the University of Natal Medical School. Barney Pityana, with whom Steve would later establish the Black Consciousness Movement, remembers the first time the two of them met when Steve arrived at Loveday College. After finishing primary school, Barney, as one of the top students in Port Elizabeth, received what was then known as the Andrew Smith Bursary, which was given to the best performing students at the time. He remembers that Loveday, under Principal John Bennion, was run like a typical English public school with very rigid rules, lots of hard work, plenty of sport, and also was very religious. Barney was in the so-called academic track, Form 1A, Form 2A, and Form 3A. A class ahead of them was, of course, the late political scientist Sam Noluchungu, who was then a star of Loveday and a favorite of the school principal. Barney recalls, and I quote, "We got there at the time of the strikes. Thabo Mbeki had just been expelled, and there were rumblings about that. Chris Hani had just finished and was now at Fort Hare, but would sneak in to give political classes. Zola Skweyiya was doing Form 5 at the time and would give us classes in political education, and so did Andrew Masonga." I hope the connection between this and Steve's political consciousness and the history of the Eastern Cape is clear at this point. Barney Pityana also remembers Steve as an incredibly bright student, and I quote, "Then in 1963, a guy arrived to join us in Form 4A. At that time, we had little academic respect for township high school students. But this guy was giving us a run for our money. And that was Steve," close quote. But Steve, of course, was expelled from Loveday because of the political activities of his older brother. And as I said earlier on, at that time, Steve would rather be a prankster than join any parade. But when he was expelled because of his brother's political activism, his brother was very thankful. As he put it to me, the giant was awakened. Because that was probably the most politicized moment in Steve Biko's life. He couldn't understand the injustice of it all. Couldn't understand that he had to spend the whole year out of school, and that his brother wasn't allowed to attend school anywhere in the country. But it is his brother, of course, who got him a place, who applied on Steve's behalf at St. Francis College at Marion Hill. According to Steve's friend, Jeff Bagua, St. Francis, with his rather liberal culture, provided Steve with a space for serious political reflection that he needed. Bakwa described Steve's role, increasing leadership role at Lovedale, as follows. We need clarity on things such as UDI in Rhodesia, and that's where Steve showed. And when Churchill died, Steve was there to describe the political implications. He was able to make all those connections and link them to what was going on in South Africa at the time. My own relationship with Steve obviously goes beyond my interest, my own childhood curiosity. It extends, of course, to the political choices that I made in my own life. When I got to Wits University as a first-year student, I was accosted by probably the most popular student leader at the time, Tiego Moseneke. Came knocking at my door. He wanted to know if he could put a poster announcing one meeting or the other on my door. Sure, I said. That was soon followed by a series of other visits by other student leaders from an organization called AZASO, the Azanian Students Organization. And they were urging me to join their organization. Given my own history, it was most logical for me to join a student organization. And then one day, a close friend, Kwezi Gobos, came fuming, asking me how it is that a boy from Ginsberg could have an AZASO poster on his door. Did I have no loyalty to Steve Biko? This was clear political blackmail. Unbeknownst to me at the time, AZASO was once the student wing of the Azanian People's Organization, AZAPO. AZAPO was formed by, among others, Ishmael Mkabela, Sam Tlobatla, and Laibon Mabasa as the custodian of black consciousness. And so it was expected that AZASO would carry the message to the universities. But of course, AZASO broke away from AZAPO and crossed the line to become part of the broader UDF, ANC, non-racial movement. So I wasn't really expected by my friends to be part of that. This probably explains why I've never been part of the ANC, which explains why I became, of course, a member of the Black Consciousness Movement. I suspect in some kind of loyalty, as an expression of some kind of loyalty to Steve Biko. Now, critics of the book, Biko, a biography, have complained, and perhaps righteously, about my own presence in the narrative. And I plead as guilty as charged. I invoke Nietzsche in mitigation of sentence. Every written work, Nietzsche observed, is in some ways a personal confession of its author and a kind of involuntary and unconscious memoir. I also invoke, in further mitigation, Zygmunt Bauman's observation that authors of narratives can hardly eradicate or dissolve their presence in the products of their work. Some are just more honest about it than others. A more serious charge has been that this work, placing Biko in the intellectual history of the Eastern Cape, is a form of tribalism. Self-styled Bikoist Andile Ngutama wrote what was called a review about the book, and I quote what he wrote. That man who drags us to the Eastern Cape. You don't have to go if you don't want. I'm not dragging you, but I found that choice of word particularly instructive. Man who drags us to the Eastern Cape and to Ginsberg. One is left to wonder whether it is not Manu's obsession with his own tribal lineage that makes him trace Biko's philosophical genealogy to Kosanet instead of Martinique, the home of Frantz Fanon. What connects Biko to Yinzane, Nwele, and other Cape Colony personalities is an accident of birth and nothing more. Christ. I think that one bears repeating. But what connects Biko to Yinza, Ngwele, and other Cape Colony personalities is an accident of birth and nothing more. Ginsberg is like any other township, nothing special there. Close quote. And that comes from a Bigoist. In this rendition, of course, Biko comes out of nowhere. He has no political or intellectual history. He has no family history. He has no teachers or priests or just older guys who shaped his life. And of course, he is not part of any intellectual lineage. He's got no connection to Loveday. He's got no connection to his own brother. He enters the stage when he meets Frantz Fanon. In my response to this charge, I can only quote what Biko himself said about the need to study these 19th century warriors, not personalities. Biko wrote that heroes like Makana, who were essentially revolutionaries, not personalities, are painted as superstitious troublemakers who lied to people about bullets turning into water. Great nation builders like Shaka are cruel tyrants who often attacked smaller tribes for no reason but for some sadistic purpose. Close quote. But Biko also writes that a lot of attention has to be paid to our history if we as blacks are going to aid each other in coming into our consciousness. We have to rewrite our history and produce in it the heroes that form the core of our resistance to the white invaders. More has to be revealed and stress has to be laid on the successful nation-building attempts of men such as Shaka, Mushweshwe, and Yinza. That was Steve Biko in his own words. Now, if my earlier curiosity about Biko was that of a child and later that of a political activist, student leader, my curiosity now is that of an adult in search of this grander narrative of African intellectual thought and how it shaped Biko and how he in turn became part of what Paula Bergsieder calls the invisible lineage of ideas, going back to the 19th century. And as Eugene Weber writes in Peasants into Frenchmen, when one looks for different things, one sees different things. When I was younger, I was fascinated by a whole lot of stuff about Biko and Ginsberg. But now I'm looking for different things, and I'm seeing different things. As an adult, academic, and writer, I've over the years gained a much more informed understanding of the role of black consciousness in the world of ideas. I have discovered that black consciousness, like most black nationalist movements, was rather ironically born in the bosom of Western modernity. As Louis Ngosi put it in his characteristically colorful language, black nationalist movements are, and I quote, the bastard children of Western modernity. Louis Ngosi argues that in their efforts to liberate themselves from the civilized decorum of Western culture, black writers, in particular, were obliged to make use of the weapons which that culture had itself furnished. It is thus not insignificant that the black consciousness movement in South Africa was indeed born at one of the bastions of white liberalism and Western modernity, the University of Natal. in conversation with white liberal and later radical students. One of the reviewers of the book, of my book, before it was published, suggested that what was happening between LIGO, the Black Consciousness Movement, the SASO, the Southern Students Organization, and NUSAS was better understood as a form of peer rivalry. I was initially offended by this, but in retrospect, you may have had a point. For what was happening between SASO and NUSAS may not have been that dissimilar to the fight between John Tengo Jabavu and James Stewart at Loveden College, or between Elijah Makiwane, Pambani Mzimba, and members of the Christian Church about what form Christianity should take. These were historical struggles over who shall shape African modernity. In broadening my intellectual horizon, I've also discovered that the idea of consciousness itself has been at the center of the human quest for meaning since time immemorial. Didn't start with LIGO. But what is significant is to place LIGO in that history. The term culture itself, which of course was very important to LIGO, entered mainstream political thought in the 18th century, of course in response to Enlightenment rationalism. And as Isaiah Berlin has demonstrated, these cultural movements, were often emerging as responses after waves of rationalism. And they arose as a response, of course, of the denigrated and the oppressed. The flowering of rationalism in Greece in the 4th century BC, for example, was followed by an equal flowering of cults and narcissism. The achievement of Roman law and the legal structure of Judaism were followed by the rise of Christianity. It is no surprise then that by the end of the 19th century, a number of scholars, many of them of German descent, questioned the foundations of Enlightenment rationality. They rejected the idea that people were simply calculating rational beings who looked out only for their individual material interests. If that is how people lived, then it should be seen more as an aberration than as a practice that was to be held as a standard. By bringing culture into the public discourse, the German writers were bringing about a corrective to a culture that had turned completely rationalistic and materialistic. In Consciousness and Society, H. Stuart Hughes described these thinkers as a cluster of genius. A number of thinkers who independently began to wonder whether these emotional involvements, far from being merely extraneous, might not be the central element in the story of freedom. Hughes wrote, and this is very important to the understanding of Black consciousness, in this sense, the new doctrines were manifestly subjective. Psychological process had replaced external reality as the most pressing topic for investigation. It was no longer what actually existed that seemed most important. It was what men thought existed, and what they felt on the unconscious level had become rather more interesting than what they consciously rationalized. A prime example, of course, of the turn towards interiority as the basis of political action was the Romantic movement, which in turn inspired the populist movement in Russia and the United States, interestingly enough. Rejecting Enlightenment formalism and the idea promoted by Jeremy Bentham that human beings were naturally selfish. The Romantics looked to poetry, to folklore, to the arts to plumb deeper into people's consciousness and capacity for solidarity. And those are exactly the things that we could tend to in building black consciousness and plumbing into the consciousness of black people. Poetry, folklore, writing, and the art became tools in the struggle against apartheid in the 1970s. So I've discovered these things about Biko. I've also discovered how he actually dealt with the whole issue of identity. According to his friend Elrod Stubbs, Biko's singular important contribution may well be in the manner in which he de-essentialized identity. Stubbs writes that it was a special strength of the Black Consciousness Movement that from the beginning in the 1960s, SASO had been open to colors and Indians. I am not sure, Stubbs writes, that the importance of this achievement in the given social structures of South Africa has been emphasized enough. But the way in which SASO managed to overcome traditional barriers between Africans and colors was not only indicative of a new mood in the colored community, but a significant achievement of non-ethnic solidarity. This approach to identity is particularly important in our age of racial nativism and ethnic chauvinism. The other day, the spokesman of the ANC, Jackson Mthembu, stooped so low as to call Lindiwe Mazibuko an African. My response, which hopefully will be published in this Sunday's City Press, is as follows. The real and present danger with the current racial and ethnic nativism is that cultural identity has become a political tool to create insider-outsider cleavages within the black world and in society at large. And now we are told that Lindiwe Mazibuko is not African because she's on the other side of the political divide. But what gives these cultural gatekeepers the right to define who belongs in the African community? Disagree with the woman if you want, but don't attack her identity, if only because you will have to do that to so many others like her. Before you know it, you'll find yourself on a slippery slope to Rwanda or Bosnia, many of the societies that have been blighted by ethnic cleansing. Close quote. The unfortunate part about this chauvinism is that its pervariance invoke Biko and black consciousness. Some critics have even bridled at the all too obvious connections I make in the book about the relationship between the Xhosa and the Khoisa, and that how that in turn shaped our identities. The purists want to deny that the colors are the colors and the Xhosas are the Xhosas, and they call themselves Negroists. The long histories of intermarriage between the Khoisan and the Xhosa have of course resulted in a language, Xhosa, that has, Jeff Peris observes, 1/6 of his vocabulary coming from the Khoisan, and the sounds are of clear Khoisan origin. At least I claim two in my name, Olela, Manzi. So I am as Khoisan as I am Xhosa, if the language that I speak is part of my identity. But those who in search of a purest past will distort Biko and even someone like Frantz Fanon. Fanon, like Biko, was very skeptical about the ready racialization of everything, such as the silly argument that only white people love dogs. The president was perhaps not aware, and that is why this history must be written by us and taught to our students. The president was perhaps not aware of S.E.K. Mqhayi's poem, Mbambushi, which he wrote in 1908, in praise of a dog. In ironic praise of a dog in fact, called Mbambushi, that was Chief Ngqika's favorite dog. But Ngqika spoiled the dog, and yet Ngqika was not right. The dog was so spoiled that it often grabbed meat from the chief's courtiers when they were eating. If anyone dared complain, the dog would throw them to the ground. And then one day the dog took a piece of meat from Nigga's own plate, from the chief's own plate. Whereupon the chief complained, "Atina amawit, where are my people?" The dog did as it already had done. It attacked and threw the chief to the ground. Whereupon he called on the community to kill it. All of this controversy about Mbambushi, written about by Mkai in 1908, more than 100 years ago, was lost on the president. This is the controversy that was taking place among dark-skinned, Xhosa-speaking African men. Race had nothing to do with it, or as Fanon would put it, enough of this rubbish. Fanon similarly pointed to the danger of this mindset. And I quote Fanon, and it's interesting how people selectively quote people like Fanon and Biko to suit their own agendas. "This historical obligation," wrote Fanon, "in which men of African culture racialize their claims and speak more of African culture than national culture, leads these men down a cul-de-sac." Close quote. We're going to put it this way, that while it may be relevant, and it was relevant, it remains relevant, of course, to talk about black in relation to white, we must not make this our preoccupation, for it can be a negative exercise. Close quote. Steve Biko, and this is the concluding remark I started earlier on, argued for what he called the joint culture. And I quote Biko again, "We have whites here who are descended from Europe. We don't dispute that. But for God's sake, the joint culture must have African experience as well." He writes, and I quote him again, "Cultures affect each other, you know, like fashions." I didn't know Steve knew anything about fashion. "Cultures affect each other, you know, like fashions. And you cannot avoid rubbing against someone else's culture. But of course, you must have the right to reject or not reject." This is the nuance that people miss about me. Because he says you must have the right to reject or not reject anything that is given to you. Choice is important. At the moment, he wrote, we exist sort of as a limb of white culture. But there can be no question that what we're yearning for is a joint culture in an open, non-racial society. That is the goal. And so I conclude that if what we see is what we look for, or if we look for different things and we see different things, many of those things we may not see because they are deeply hidden in this history that I've just outlined. But Biko may be a first place to start in fighting the racial and ethnic chauvinism of our times. Thank you. Happy to take questions in a few minutes after me. Go ahead.
I think a lot of our spirit yesterday's lecture and Colin Bundy on the Govan Mbeki, and it's a startling contrast. Govan Mbeki, whole meaning of his life practically, was the persuasion of his people as a, what did he call him, organic intellectual, into Marxism. And the whole socialist movement of the world, which was then moving, stopped dead since, propelled him. This appears to have had no influence in Biko's life, not only Biko, but his generation in Fortown. Why did it die out like that?
Somebody was telling me, you know, as I was doing research for my book, that Steve, when he was drunk and partying and all of that, used to make all kinds of silly remarks about the whites and the communists and their influence on black people, and he would have these arguments with some of the Marxists in the movement. I don't know, other than to say that it may well have been they were university students, not really connected to communities until later, of course, in the way that people like Mbeki were connected. I think the rise of nationalism in the world, black nationalism in the world, was the space in which they were operating more than Marxism at the time. I mean, black consciousness and black, everybody in the United States and everyone was speaking that language. So I suspect they may not have had the kind of intellectual and community resource that somebody like Govan Mbeki may have had. But Steve was very ambivalent around issues like Marxism. I mean, he would say we're looking for a socialist, Azania, but that would be nothing more than a lie in his writings. So it doesn't seem that he was, I think he was animated more by cultural issues of consciousness and cultural politics. I call it.
Can I put a footnote to the first question and then I'll ask myself? When Vico is becoming politically active, the suppression of communism is nearly 20 years old. The suppression of communism now. There is no visible active access to socialist ideas. When Govan was a courtier, you subscribed to the Liberal Library, Idiru was addressing students on the Sandiles Cop, and so on. Two very different contexts. Mm. But for that, what I think you've done so importantly is remind us of the link between ideas and oppositional politics. And I would add generation to that, a particular kind of generational consciousness. And I think of the 1930s, Govan Mbeki's decade, what H.I.E. de Longo called the New Africans. I think of the early 1940s, A.P. Mundell, Anton Lebede, Robert Sobukwe, and the impulses that fed into the youth league. And I think of what you're telling us about, the late 1960s and early 70s, and the rise of this assertive, distinctive, thought-free black consciousness. And my question for you is, where is their corollary today? Do you see anything in South Africa at the moment that resembles those convergences of a generation of ideas, of education, and sharp oppositional politics?
Sadly enough, I mean, they are not there. I in this piece that hopefully City Press will publish, I conclude by saying to Jackson Tim that I'm very disappointed about the ANC, and then I say, and of course I'm entitled to my own feelings, Jackson. In other words, we are almost like, and I had a fight with Paulo Jordan about this, but we are in some kind of intellectual cultural wasteland right now. And that's why I'm going to teach our students this stuff. When I tell my students in sociology this history, they're like, even my colleagues, they're like, but where has this stuff been all these years? So they say the first time they hear it. So I think that in our universities, in the citizens' movement, I mean, there's a lot of talk now about citizenship. The historical question that I would pose back to you is, when do these movements come back and amount to these little things? When do they actually come back to become part of a tidal wave? I don't know. But it's important for us to actually do the consciousness raising through our writings and through our teaching. I do want to say, though, that the 1880s, for me, were just remarkable. And that whole period between 1860 and the end of that century, in terms of the intellectual production, I say it makes the drum generation seem like, second to last. The kind of intellectual production that was happening at that time, and we need to do more to write about that.
Would you ascribe the paucity of vision at this time to the difference in the quality of education that the generation of Mandela and Tambo had to the leaders of today, the Zumas, etc.? Complete different educational backgrounds.
But in many ways, we are the ones who created the mess in our education in many, many ways over the past, two decades or so. I think it's leadership. You know, I think that because even people like Nico, yes, they were getting good education. We went to township schools. And we were in the 1980s pretty much involved intellectually and politically. I think that what has happened, it's a paradox of freedom. You have this paradox of we were reared in institutions and the language of freedom, but not the language of democracy. And the language of democracy is something that we are now only beginning to grapple with. And I think that that's part of the reason is that, and then of course, you know, the fact that the people are in power, they don't care about those things anymore. They don't care about ideas, theories. In fact, the word intellectual has kind of become a swear word. You know, people say, Tolela, yourself so-called intellectual. But to put you down, when there was a time when to be an intellectual was source of pride. So we have lost, it's almost like the lineage has been broken. I don't know what it's going to take to actually cultivate it back.
But again, the kids that are going to private schools are receiving a different quality of education and maybe more along, about democracy than the kids that are going to the township schools.
As a professor here, I'm actually disappointed by the education that our kids get in private schools. It's really not good. I went to a township school. I was writing much, much better than the kids who go to St. John's. But yes, there is, of course, the inequality in the education. And the kids who go to private schools, how many of them are interested also what's going to be a game changer for me though is that I think 2014 we're going to see young people from across the spectrum. I think you'll find that the ANC is going to be squeezed by the kids from private schools who are unhappy about the country in general, what they hear, what they read, and all of that, black and white. And then there's going to be the kids who are at the bottom of the rank. And they're going to sandwich, I think, the ANC. I mean, 60% of the population is under 35. And many of the kids who were born in 1994 will be eligible to vote now. So what's going to change, of course, is that there's going to be a new, I think, either in 2014 or in 2019, a new dynamic. Whether that will become part of the consciousness raising that Colin was talking about, I don't know. Whether those kids will be as educated as we were is doubtful. That makes our job even more important. Thank you very much.